Your world unfolding.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Welcome to Big Ideas on RN and at abc.net.au. Tonight, a difficult topic and a difficult period in our history, Queensland's frontier killing times. I should say, too, the details of tonight's discussion are distressing. This is not to run away from those details, but to remind you, it's a tough story. Cairns-based historian Timothy Bottoms has drawn a new map of Queensland that places many more sites of massacres of Aboriginal people into the story than have ever been acknowledged before. Even if it's a story you're familiar with, what historian Timothy Bottoms has done is to bring together detail and research, to plot the places where things happened, to stand witness, perhaps. And while he argues this is a story of deep silences, what he demonstrates is how public and talked about these killings were in the 19th century. Historian Dr. Timothy Bottoms, who lives and writes from Cairns in far north Queensland, has written a history of Cairns and another, Jabbergay Country. His latest book is Conspiracy of Silence, Queensland's Frontier Killing Times. RN's Kate Evans is speaking here to Timothy Bottoms in front of an audience in Brisbane. There are many Indigenous people in attendance who have a stake in this story, and we'll be hearing their understanding of it a bit later on. But firstly, here's Kate Evans with Timothy Bottoms.
Timothy, why do you call it a conspiracy of silence? Because reading this book, what comes through to me is how many people, particularly in 19th century Australia, were aware of the violence that was happening in the frontier.
People at the time actually called it a conspiracy of silence. That's the fascinating part, is that once you start going through the primary sources, including newspapers, diaries, personal letters, you find that people are referring to it as a conspiracy of silence. And with the fact that the Queensland government, the executive, Governor Bowen, kick-started it all with and set basically the precedent for how governments interacted, and that was to sideline or ignore those people who were complaining about the behaviour of the native police and the killings that were going on the frontier. And because of that, that is hiding the truth. And then we find by the 1890s, we have the development of what has become called the pioneering myth, which is a falsehood, really. It ignores the truth about what went on. And by the time we get into the 20th century, we have everybody believing that somehow or another that it was a peaceful settlement. Certainly by the time I was going to school in the 60s, I firmly believed that Australia was settled peacefully. And I had a brilliant history teacher at school, but he was an American, but the history that he'd learnt didn't mention anything about the violence. And that's why I feel that it's most appropriate to call it conspiracy of silence.
So what is it then that you're wanting to do with this book? Is it to tell untold stories or to add detail to the stories that are already there in some way?
Well, there's several levels. Firstly, one needs to contextualise what has gone on. A lot of the stories about massacres are very vague. You can't actually pinpoint where they are. That's why I identify them geographically, so that you can actually look at a map and get some idea about how and where they were occurring. The other aspect really is that by mapping these massacres, you have a better chance of understanding the extent of violence on the frontier. It wasn't just one or two massacres. It was everywhere, in every region.
And this is, of course, often a contested history, and it's often discussed as if it's about counting the numbers. Mm. So how have you approached that?
Well, you can't really count the numbers. That's the problem. Not in the fashion that some of the denialists suggest. Because people were hiding the truth, about what was going on. They obviously were not proud of it. There's enough comments in the primary sources about what would Mother England think of this and that sort of attitude. There's the classic case of when the Jamaican riots were occurring and there were 400 slaves killed, and the author of that, who had written to the editor, was busily saying, well, you know, that happens, you know, every year on the frontier in Australia. So we have to start realising that the violence was ubiquitous. And it was devastating with trying to get to the actual numbers. You find people mention numbers, but then they back off from doing it. They say that there were, say, 300, you know, involved. But they don't actually go into the details, and nobody goes around counting them afterwards. And certainly we don't have any records of them being written down. But we do know that large numbers of people were killed, because there are huge gaps in genealogies of Aboriginal people. And we have the archaeological evidence that there were thousands of people living in an area. Particularly we have this with central Queensland in the mining region around Nebo and Moranbah. We know that there were thousands of people there because of the archaeological surveys that have been done. Where are they now? There are only six families now claiming small areas in that area where, you know, there must have been umpteen thousand people. And we know from the interactions going on in the Northern Territory that the Territorian newspapers were commenting about the Queenslanders and their violence, and how they'd brought this approach to the frontier around Borroloola and the area adjacent in the territory to the Gulf Country.
Well, let's talk about Queensland then, because this is a national story too. So what are you saying about Queensland? What is it that's different about what happened in this state?
Well, in Victoria, you have a certain level of violence. We believe that massacres were around 5-6 people on occasions. But the thing about how we see the change throughout the colonial period is the early period in Victoria, the British government had a quite a tight control over what was going on in the colonies. And you also had firearms that were not as devastating as the ones that were used in Queensland, because Queensland was becoming particularly active in the 1860s and 1870s. I mean, there was violence before then, but the firepower of the squatters and the native police was so much more devastating as the 19th century progressed. You also had in Queensland the British government's interest in controlling the treatment of Indigenous people weighed or started to waver, and they were more interested in helping the British investments on the frontier. And also you had a lot of Victorians expanding out of Victoria and investing in Queensland and moving forward. I mean, Will's party, for example, who were wiped out at Cullamaringo, they came from Victoria.
So are you saying then that this is also part of the convict story of Queensland or not?
Oh, I don't know about the... It's involved, but I wouldn't necessarily link them. The convict period basically finished in 1839. You had the opening up of the Moreton Bay settlement area, i.e. Brisbane, after 1842. Now, we did have some massacres in the convict era, certainly on North Stradbroke and Moreton Island, but the real violence, I think, kicks off once you start looking at the squatters moving out into the Maranoa, Darling Downs, and then as you had the violence as the frontier moved, then it settled down and then it moved and it kept on moving and it was never static, so that you could say that at any one particular time the frontier was locked in one particular position. That's why it keeps changing. If you look at the maps at the start of the book, you can see that it kept moving. Squatters kept on rushing out to try and peg out another selection.
Well, you talk about movement, and one of the stories that I found particularly striking was when you talked about what happened in the areas around the Bunya Mountains, because that is also, of course, about Aboriginal people moving to the Bunyas, as they had for an incredibly long time, and then encountering the movement that was happening with settlers. So what happened there, and what does that tell you about both landscape and violent conflict?
Well, you had with the Bunya Bunya Festival, I think it was every 4 years, and an absolute wealth of food and large gatherings of Aboriginal people from north and south and west. And we're talking long distances from what is now northern New South Wales and just below roughly Rockhampton. There were Aboriginal people travelling vast distances to come to this festival. And what happened with white settlers or the squatters was, of course, that they found it a nuisance because these people were moving through their traditional territory or what they'd already taken over. And the Native Matter Police saw this as an opportunity to actually attack Aboriginal people because they were gathering. Now, they used any excuse of Aboriginal people getting together as a means of saying, well, they're planning some attack on white people. More often than not, it seems to me from my readings, is that they were gathering for ceremony and that was the real work, and they weren't really taking any notice of these white strangers, as big a nuisance as they might have been. But the Native Matter Police were sent in to get rid of any large gatherings of Aboriginal people, and that's what happened in the Bunya Bunya area. And the politicians were the business people. They were investing in timber yards, they're investing in all kinds of new developments.
So can you pin it down as part of formal government policy or not, this level of violence?
Well, certainly research by colleagues of mine in here in Brisbane have proved that Governor Bowen and the executive were involved in making decisions. For example, I think it was about 1864 with Fanny Briggs just outside of, she was a young white woman just outside of Rockhampton. She was raped and murdered by members of the Native Matter Police. Robert Orson Jensen has found the documents of a meeting with the governor and the executive council, demonstrating that they had ordered officers to do away with the offending Native police troopers.
Tell us about the role of the Native police. And I know we've got people in the audience here who will know that history, but if we're thinking again about a national audience who might be listening, remind us who they are, because you make a very strong argument about their role in this, don't you?
Oh, indeed. The Native Matter Police really, I think by the time you look at their operations, I consider them as death squads. They were used to quell Aboriginal ownership of land by when there are large gatherings. The thing about the Native Matter Police was that they were trained, armed, supplies, the horses, everything was government funded. And they had white subalterns who trained them, sub-inspectors and then inspectors, and they were all answerable to the Commissioner of Police eventually and the Colonial Secretary.
So what sort of period are we talking about when they're at their height?
Well, certainly from 1861 through to probably the early 1890s, although they were still operating, but to hide the fact that by the turn of into the 20th century, most of the native troopers they started to call them trackers, when in fact some of them were still doing the same role that they were before, but not as obviously. And of course that was the whole point, is that the native police, when operating, weren't supposed to do it so that they could be seen. And that was the problem with the chaps who raped and killed Fanny Briggs, was that they didn't do it. The behaviour was too obvious for people, and you weren't to be seen. You had to keep quiet about it.
And so what happened in that case? That was near Rockhampton?
That one, yes. But there are better examples than that. I was just trying to remember the example. It's slipped my mind at the moment.
You call them death squads. Are you being provocative, or do you think that's just what they are? Tell me why you use that term, death squads.
Well, if you were Aboriginal and you were going about your business and the Native Manor Police came along, you were a fair target. And they were out to kill you. And it's pretty patently obvious that that's what they were about. But you had to keep quiet about the Native Police had to keep quiet about it. I mean, obviously the troopers weren't particularly involved in talking to journalists or anything like that, but the sub-inspectors were the ones. And, I mean, all you've got to do is look at the behaviour of Sub-Inspector O'Connor up in Cooktown, where he and his troopers went to Cape Bedford and ended up killing about 28 Aboriginal men, women and children, driving the last lot into the water and keeping them out in the water so that they couldn't come back, so they drowned, and so with quite openly talking about it.
Well, with an awful example like that, tell us how you track that story. Where do you find the traces of a story like that?
Well, there's a coverage in the newspaper, and Bishop Hale actually wrote to Arthur Palmer about this and complaining that Palmer was going to send O'Connor down with his troopers to track Ned Kelly in Victoria, and that this was inappropriate. And in the actual archives documents are the newspaper cuttings talking about what O'Connor's been doing. And, you know, Bishop Hale asking Palmer, you know, why are you doing this? What is the justification? And Palmer just dismisses him.
So what happens? And because one of the things that that I found confronting in reading your book is not just the detail, which is confronting enough, but is the level of evidence there. People calling for inquiries, people saying, what are you going to do about this? So what happens? Does it systematically get buried, ignored?
Yes. That's the simple. They just simply ignored it. They'd made their policy decision and they stuck rigidly to it for, over 40 years.
Tell us about the... I mean, you've mentioned O'Connor as one particular policeman who had a big impact, but there are a number of brothers who were...
Jardines.
The Jardines. Tell us about the Jardines and what role they played.
Well, what is interesting is that they drove about 400 or 500 head of cattle up the west coast of Cape York in 1864, and along the way they shot about 72 Aboriginal men. And at one particular place, at the Alice River, just above where it junctions with the Mitchell River, they came across a gathering of 80 men. Now, if you've got a gathering of 80 men, there aren't any women or children around the place, odds on that this is for ceremony. So it's work, as far as the local top-end mob were concerned. And they got stuck into them with... they fired off something like 51 cartridges. They killed over 30 men out of the 80, and then wrote it up as if it was the Battle of the Mitchell River. It was nothing of the sort. These men were going about their own religious ceremonial practices, and you know, a bunch of hick white men on horseback come along and proceed to shoot the living daylights out of them, and then keep going and shoot other people on other instances along the way.
Were they hicks without any power, though, or were they people who ended up, were they seen as powerful men? What role did they have in Queensland?
Well, not until they got up to Somerset, where their father had set up what was considered to be, or was planned to be, the Singapore of Australia. It didn't pan out that way. But no, they were quite violent men. There are lots of stories in oral history of the violence that was meted out to Aboriginal people up the top end. Even some of the Aboriginal men who worked for them, were at the receiving end of violence. And yet, the absolute irony or hypocrisy is that we have, you know, a motel on Thursday Island named after Jardine. We have a river named after Jardine. We have another river just outside of Caranda, just outside of Cairns, called the Closey River, named after Sub-Inspector Closey. We've got the
Who
Johnson Shire. Sub-Inspector, he was a member of the Native Mounted Police. You got Sub-Inspector Robert Arthur Johnson. He was a murderer, this man. And we've got a river named after him, we've got a shire named after him, and there are innumerable examples of that right throughout the state, where these people have been transformed from what they really were into some sort of heroified Australian, and it's most inappropriate, and Aboriginal people living in the regions know that.
You are mapping the sites, but in a sense you're also rereading the landscape, aren't you?
Yes. Because it needs to be rethought, because it doesn't make sense the way it was portrayed under the pioneering myth. We need to have a rethink about who and what we are as Australians. And it's not just about the violence on the frontier. If we take that logically, how do we manage to hide it for over 150 years? Why did this lie come about? We had the same thing with the convict era, where it was hidden. Up until roughly 1988, when with the bicentenary, where people became quite proud of their convict ancestry, we've got examples from the 50s, 60s and 70s of women who, if they got pregnant, had to go to another town a long way away and give birth, have their child adopted. There was shame. Let's keep it quiet. Let's hide it. And so many times, and we've got this with currently in the armed forces, women who have been raped, and they are being penalised by a system that won't give them the acknowledgement and support that they deserve. And we found this in so many aspects in the public service, where people who are whistleblowers are, shoot the messenger, don't take it on board, don't do the positive, let's not make our country a better country by taking on positive critical comment and improve a situation, let's hide it some more and make it worse, which is what unfortunately seems to be the case. This is the lesson we need to learn from this.
Well, let's talk more about how you get rid of that silence and the steps that you've taken to do it. Now, I know that you're actually holding some examples from the archive. There's blood in the archive, isn't there?
Well, not literally, but yes, there is, certainly in the written form. But, I mean, it's not just in the archives. I mean, there's only the three examples I was thinking of. There was the obvious one from Steele Rudd, who's famous for Dad and Dave, and most Australians certainly, and old Australians are aware of the radio program and the series that ran. But his father, Thomas Davis, he participated in the Killing Times, which he acknowledged in his recollections. And he recalled that in 1856, word was received that the blacks were gathering on Donga Creek. Now, that's about 30 kilometres east of the station, with the object of attacking Werribone Station, which is about 30 kilometres southwest of Surat, several kilometres east of the Boulogne River. Now, they'd already slaughtered a number of Matthew Gogg's cattle, and with a feeling of boy's own adventures, Davis described how, with little delay, a well-equipped party consisting of Sergeant David Graham and Black Police Dick Walker, he's a white man, once an officer in the English Army, James Norman, Matthew Goggs, Harry Whitty and myself, were soon riding hard through sand and mulga towards Donga Creek. There, camped on both sides of the stream, was a mob of fully 400 blacks. With our firearms resting on our thighs, we rode up. Though confused, they stubbornly held their ground. Into the thick of them, we emptied our pieces. Their tactics became warlike. In a short time, we were almost surrounded. Compelled to fall back, we separated and from behind trees cut gaps in their numbers with our rifles. Still, their determination never lessened. Some of our party were wounded, myself among the number. A spear pierced my thigh and pinned me to the saddle. Fair in the face of powder and ball, rushed two or three daring fellows, making for Dick Walker. Only one reached him. They fell, rolled, struggled in the grass. Walker dropped his revolver. His hand went quickly to his side, and the next instant, the naked man was ripped from the lower part of his abdomen to his brisket. The shades of night came down, and we rode some miles and camped. Rest or sleep, we could not.
And so this is memoir, not just some imagined boy's own adventure.
Yeah, it's a memoir and you can access it on the internet. It's that available.
There's a number of examples which we'll get to as we keep talking. But one of the other things that the other traces that you seem to be exploring is the actual names in the landscape. Because, of course, Australia is full of places called Dead Man's Bluff, Murdering Swamp. What Skull happens?
Yeah,
what are those other places in Queensland, for example, that you've explored?
Well, there's Massacre Inlet. That's on the Gulf. The problem with that is that we don't really have anybody left to identify from that area. They're possibly related to the Cardinal people, but we're not really sure. We have other places, like Skull Lagoon, Skull Pocket, just about everywhere you want to name. There, Skeleton Creek, these sorts of names. They're right around the country.
The other places that are part of this story, of course, are pastoral stations, places where squatters settled and so on. And there's one example that's particularly interesting, I think, and that's a story around somebody who called himself H7H. Can you explain that story and how you investigated it?
Yes, well, H7H wrote to the Townsville Herald in 1907, and in that he described how there were several massacres. He gives quite a fervent description. But in this, I thought, well, hang on a minute. What does H7H mean? So I contacted the Department of Primary Industries, and blow me down, it was Isis Downs.
So it was a cattle brand, is
that? Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And so I then looked in the region of Isisford and found that there was the manager, one of the co-owners of Isis Downs, was a fellow who was killed by the local Aboriginal people. And the problem with that is that H7H then gives descriptions of two massacres that followed.
So was he a participant? Is that what he was describing, or something that
yes.
he'd witnessed?
Yes, no, he claims he was a participant. Some of the points he made... Between Blackall and Longreach, we know of a series of collisions in response to the murder of a white man in late October 1867. John Fanning, who was part owner and manager of Isis Downs, some 30 years later, under the heading Taming the Niggers, an old pioneer calling himself H7H, the cattle brand for Isis Downs, wrote to the Townsville Herald describing the two attacks of a large group of local Koongari, who it was presumed were responsible for station owner Fanning's death. Now, H7H bragged of his involvement in the first retaliatory expedition, where he said, "It was estimated that over 150 miles bit the dust that morning, and unfortunately, many women and children shared the same fate. In that wild, yelling, rushing mob, it was hard to avoid shooting the women and babies, and there were men in that mob of whites who would ruthlessly destroy anything possessing a black hide." Later, he described a second stealthy early morning raid by the European party. "They slept soundly those miles under the long march and could have had no thought of us being so close to them, for we were within revolver shot of them before our presence was discovered, and it was then too late, for muddled with sleep, sore-footed, weary and panic-stricken, they offered no resistance, and many of them were wiped out before they could gain their feet. Talk of the furies of hell, that night's work amongst those miles with the white man's rifle and tomahawk would make hell's fury blush. How those gins and kiddies shrieked when we got amongst them. The blood of the white man was up and nothing with a black hide escaped death that night. For when we had finished our work and drawn off, and in daylight came to view the white man's work of vengeance, bucks, gins and pickaninnies were lying dead in all directions and not a thing in camp moved or breathed." Now, this was printed in a daily newspaper of a major provincial city in 1907, 6 years after Federation, and the writer was confessing to mass murder without the slightest concern about prosecution or even social opprobrium.
Well, and the language, obviously, it's very hard to hear that now, but also 1907, that seems very recent. I mean, one of the arguments that's been made about Queensland is that the frontier was very late.
Yes. It ran for a period of, really from around the mid-1830s right the way through until the 1890s, because you still had people moving into areas, certainly on Cape York. They were still expanding in the 1870s and 1880s.
And I guess we've been focusing so far on the sort of conventional research and the sort of archival and paper-based research, but how important is oral history and oral tradition to the work that you do?
It's always important to take on board oral history, although it's very hard to nail the factual part of it down. But if you've got a recollection of something occurring, then you can start looking in other areas to see if there's some form of confirmation of it. You have to be cognizant that there'll be a kernel of truth in an oral history recollection.
How many more stories do you think are there that you haven't got to?
I don't know. I would imagine quite a few. But the thing about it is that whether we will ever get to the full story, I'm not so sure we'll be able to do, because a lot of the elders have passed away, and those whites who are surviving want to keep it quiet. And I don't think that the Australian public would countenance the sort of finance it will take to fund research to delve into that sort of thing. I think we've got to take it as a given that there could be much more research done other than what I've achieved. And there are plenty of researchers who have been before me and I think done a wonderful job, but how much are we prepared to back? We don't get much backing in this country for historical research.
Is it an uncomfortable history for you to write as a white man in Australia? And I guess it raises the question of whose stories you're telling.
Well, none of us today are responsible for what happened over 100 years ago. Therefore, you know, we've got to be honest about what are the influences that make our country and our nation, our national character, who and what we are. And that, I think, is the pivotal part of it all. I don't feel any guilt for... I've had no involvement, and nobody in this room has had any involvement with that sort of thing. But the violence that was perpetrated was objected to at the time. There were people objecting, and they were ignored. And there were quite a lot of people who put a lot of effort into trying to bring the government to account on these. That they failed is... You can't blame them for that. I mean, the obvious one, A.J. Vogan, for example, wrote his book, which came out in 1890, called The Black Police, and he was ostracised because of it. He couldn't get work in this country because he'd brought this to the forefront. So, yes, I think it's a matter of us as Australians taking it on board and acknowledging, well, this did go on. What can we do to try and find the common ground that can improve ourselves and our ethos as a nation?
A really important part of historical research is connecting with local history societies, with small museums, with regional places that are telling their own stories. What happens when you start to delve into this version of Australian history on a local level?
It depends on the people in each of the historical societies. I found, I don't particularly want to name societies, but I found one historical society incredibly supportive, and I thought that they were going to be very conservative and supposedly redneckish when they were anything of the sort, and yet another group who I thought was going to be very supportive were in fact the exact opposite. They owned the history, the fact that they'd never written anything particularly that other people wanted to read didn't seem to enter into the equation, but they owned it and I didn't, so therefore they weren't going to help me in any shape or form. I also found that one little country town that I'd sent an email to the librarian asking if there were any local historians, I got a response from a local historian who had been in contact with the librarian, and as soon as she suspected that I was writing a book that gave credence to an Aboriginal perspective, I never heard from her again.
What about the question of where you decide to stop this history? Because I know people argue this isn't a history with a neat endpoint, and the history of violence and killing times keeps on going and has very long resonances. At what point do you stop looking at that history?
Well, you've got the transition that begins after the 1897 Aboriginal Protection and Restriction of the Sale of Opium Act. And, you know, it really, you can see with the promulgation of the Act in 1898, and then you've got the Northern and Southern Protectors, Meston in Southern Queensland and Roth in Northern Queensland, and Roth becomes the overall protector for Queensland and did a very good job. But of course he was also doing an ethnographic record of things which were published in the Queensland Parliamentary Papers, some of the only records we've got of some Aboriginal groups. But because of his trying to enforce fair dealings with employment of Aboriginal people, particularly on the Bechtermeer fisheries around Cape York, he was reviled by quite a few of the white employers and eventually was criticised for recording pornographic aspects to Aboriginal culture and was basically driven to resign and went off to British Guiana in South America. And then you had the change, and so where you had, I think it was Blake, you had three more directors which are of the Aboriginal department. And they had total control over Aboriginal lives, where they could put them, supervise and control everything. That's how come you had, for example, after 1918, Palm Island becoming an Aboriginal jail. And it's that control through that period that changes the perspective. So the killing times aren't having, but the killing of a spirit, Aboriginal spirit, is definitely going on, because, you know, you can't receive mail without the supervisor giving you permission. You can't marry somebody if the supervisor doesn't approve. And I'm simplifying it quite dramatically. And there are lots of people who have done some really good research in that area. And when you read the stories about what's gone on and talk to Aboriginal people who lived under those circumstances, then, you know, we need to rethink, you know, what is free Australia.
Well, and I'm already sensing murmurings and responses from the room, which we'll go to in just a moment. But I will just ask you one final question before we turn to the floor. What is it, Timothy Bottoms, that you want this book to do? Because it's a grueling story. What impact do you want it to have?
I'd like to see Australians be more honest. It's idealistic, I think. But at the same time, if we don't have idealism, then what's the point? As human beings, we owe it to ourselves and to our fellow human beings to try and reach a level of interaction and promulgation of human rights that I think makes us worthwhile as a nation.
You're with Big Ideas on RN and Kate Evans in a conversation about massacres of Aboriginal people in Queensland's past, with author Timothy Bottoms talking about his book Conspiracy of Silence, Queensland's Frontier Killing Times. You can comment on this discussion on our website. Just search Big Ideas and Radio National. Do you have a story or a memory to contribute? While Timothy Bottoms drew out his research and conclusions, contributions by elders and historians in the audience made the story a live one. Back to RN's Kate Evans in Brisbane.
Well, the foreword to this book was written by historian Raymond Evans, who's not only written histories of Queensland, but he's also specialised in histories of dissent and racial politics in Queensland. And Raymond's in the audience. And so, Raymond, I wonder if you could add to that. I mean, what do you think a history like this does or needs to do?
Well, I think that Timothy has written a very confronting book indeed. And I really found that reading it, even though I have done so much work in the region for many, many decades, I found it a confronting read. So I think the ordinary Australian is going to find it even more confronting. But it's a story that absolutely needs to be told, because we need to know what our origins were like. You know, this is one of our origin stories. It's more of an origin story than the Gallipoli story. We need to know this, like we need to know the convict story. The convict story and the frontier story are the twin stories of our origins as a nation. We've got to come to terms with it. We've got to deal with it honestly before we can move on and have proper reconciliation in this country.
Well, given that very powerful question of moving on and what we do with this, I know that Bob Weatherall is also here from the Centre for Indigenous Cultural Policy, and so I wonder if you could comment on what impact these histories and stories have, not just on our sense of the past, but on what happens next.
I think it's imperative that the research, because I asked you, you asked a question there, T. Timothy, about when does it stop? Well, it doesn't stop. It can't stop. And that information, that knowledge that's out there, has got to, and the histories have got to be recorded. But I see it most importantly for Aboriginal people, because everything that Whitefellas did over here disempowered Aboriginal people. They basically removed them from the land, put them on reserves and whatever else, and they separated us from our families. And all this knowledge and all this information has been held by collecting institutions which we've got no access to. And that's part of the problem. Once we get this information, we start putting together back our identities and where we come from and our connections to our lands and to our peoples and those types of things. This is what's going to empower our people and have control back to for Aboriginal people. We know there's a white problem, and this is it. And you've got to learn to accept what is history from what actually happened. And I'm glad that you raised Donga in regards to the Donga Run, because that's my people, the Kamilaroi Gomeroi people from up there, and we remember Walker. Those stories are still around Surratt and St George, the Ballon River, Maranoa, and he come all the way down into New South Wales too. And I know there's another old gentleman over there, Uncle Dick Buckhorn will probably tell you a bit more about that as well. But I think it's really imperative that we've got to be able to have our own collecting institutions, Aboriginal people, call them knowledge centres, whatever you want, or cultural centres. But that knowledge, that information must be there for the next intergeneration so that they can continue to maintain and understand this, because that's who they are. They need to know what happened to them.
Well, you have mentioned the gentleman sitting up the front, and perhaps either of you would like to comment?
What I'd like to say is that, and it's very difficult, as a child, and not only me, but nearly all Aboriginal children and families grew up knowing this history that you're portraying today. We grew up with our parents telling us of the massacres, the stricting in the water holes that wiped out hundreds of Aboriginal people, the stricting in meat that was deliberately given to groups of Aboriginal people, murdering hundreds. We grew up with those stories. We know those stories. And my father was an Igbo man. He was of the Wiri clan of the Birriggabba people. And my mother, she's a Gungaloo woman of central Queensland. Judith Wright wrote a story, her history, her family history, Cry for the Dead. When that was published, she got death threats from white people. My mother's own story is, she told us when she was going to school in Rockhampton, and I understand from my mother and my father that you could actually get licences to go and shoot Aboriginal people.
No, we haven't got that.
Have you come across that?
I've heard people talk about it, but I found no evidence
right.
of it.
Okay, it might be interesting to look in the police museum here in Brisbane.
I think you'll find that with that, it was more a matter of, because of the attitude of the executive and the government in the way they operated, that allowed the killing of Aboriginal people, that people felt that they could do anything they wanted and get away with it. So, in a sense, a licence to kill,
right.
but not
okay,
strictly
not
speaking,
literally.
A legal one.
My mother, as a young child, she went to school in primary school with a young Aboriginal girl that was known as the last of her tribe. And how that came about was, there was a shooting party on a Sunday picnic outside Rockhampton, and the Catholic priest had gone with this shooting party, and they shot a whole group of people except for this little girl, where the Catholic priest picked her up and said, "Don't shoot her, I'll take her home." And my mother used to go to the convent, and this little girl was grown up by this Catholic priest, and she went to school with my mother, and that's how come she became known as the last of her tribe. And as I said, most Aboriginal families and children grow up knowing what the history is. And while, I mean, I'm glad you don't feel any guilt, which is very well, but whenever Aboriginal people talk about the history, the true history of this country, then we get accused of trying to make white people feel guilty. And all we are saying is the truth of the matter that has happened in this country.
You want acknowledgement.
And I think, surely, white Australians can become adult enough now to begin to own their own history in this country. And that may be a difficult thing for them, but surely Australian society is beginning to reach an age of maturity where that may happen, although maybe that's wishful thinking. At the same time, I'd also like to say that white Australians need to understand what colonialism is, what the patterns of colonialism are, and not only how it's affected Aboriginal people, but how it's affected them. It is from that that has allowed such things to happen today as the intervention. Murrunji in Palm Island, deaths in custody, where people have a duty of care, and no one has ever been charged with any deaths of these people. We're still dying. It's still happening. And yet, where is the justice? Where is it? It doesn't come. I could go on and on and say a lot more, but I won't.
Hard to take over that. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I had 8 years at Boggabulla near Gundamindi there, and got into the researching of the local history there, and found an amazing amount of primary source documents, reports, Richard Bly's investigations of a system of assassination that was had become entrenched, that he discovered, and very detailed stories. That set of documents, Mark Copland, who was a descendant of Jonathan and Margaret Young, the first white couple to give birth to a child north of the McIntyre River, I think in what's now Queensland, also did a lot of research on that and helped build the picture. We presented those documents to Gundawindi High School. I explained it to a group of teachers, and they said, "Oh, we'll have to be careful how we use these documents. Some of our students come from the properties that are mentioned there." For years we've been trying to get that local history taught in the high school. The Deaths and Custody Royal Commission made a very strong plea for that history to be known and to be shared and to be taught. But I'm afraid that Gundawindi hasn't changed very much. And, I suppose just the continuing battles to try and get history acknowledged. I remember, in the early 2000s, I think, Peter Coleman did an article reviewing a book of Henry Reynolds, in which he said, yes, there was a massacre at Myall Creek and one at Coniston, and several other massacres have been alleged.
Yes, alleged.
So a lot of letter writing, a complaint to the Press Council, and reaction was to write an article for the Adelaide Review, "My Day with the Thought Police," how he'd been dragged before this tribunal by me. And, of course, the Press Council being the Press Council, they didn't do anything about it. So there's that suppression of the history.
But you've made a very powerful case for us also of the telling of local and very particular
yes.
history
yes.
and for mapping it out in the way that I think this book has done. And so we've been speaking today to Timothy Bottoms, and I'd like you all to thank him.
That was RN's Kate Evans talking to Dr. Timothy Bottoms about his book, Conspiracy of Silence, Queensland's Frontier Killing Times. And you also heard a moving personal story from Lilla Watson, Aboriginal elder and Gungaloo woman, as well as from historian Raymond Evans and Bob Weatherall from the Centre for Indigenous Cultural Policy. That's it for Big Ideas for today. Thanks to the Big Ideas production team, Karen Zvanovitz, Ian Coombe, Peter McMurray, David LeMay and Jim Usher. I'm back tomorrow night at 10 with the best of Big Ideas on Friday Late. And on Monday on Big Ideas, who cares about Australia's Constitution? A special Constitution Day conversation.
One survey a couple of years ago asked Australians, do we have a National Bill of Rights in our Constitution? And 62% of Australians surveyed across the country said yes. We have a National Bill of Rights in this country, and I saw that myself firsthand when I travelled to Victoria talking about their State Charter of Rights, and time again I ran into Australians who said, we don't need this in Victoria, we've already got our National Bill of Rights, so we don't need a state one as well. And when I asked them what was in this National Bill of Rights, they usually said freedom of speech was the first thing, but the second thing that came up almost uniformly was they knew they could take the fifth if they got in trouble. So it gives you a sense of where are Australians getting their knowledge about our Constitution. Well, it's not from people like me, it's from Law and Order, CSI and a range of cop shows. And really, it's not the castle, it's not the vibe, it is American TV that is educating Australians about their United States Constitution.
Why is that? Why are Australian citizens getting their information, their misinformation about the Australian Constitution from American TV drama? Is it that this is an absent part of education in Australia, civics education perhaps?
Yeah, look, it is. And people often complain about civics education, but actually kids these days get a fair bit of information about the Constitution, but it's not reinforced. And unlike the United States, it's not reinforced by popular culture. We've had the castle, we've had the vibe, but I mean, that's really exceptional. There's almost nothing quite like that.
Mm.
If we had more popular culture, if perhaps we saw this flowing through into Pack to the Rafters and other shows, then I think people would know more, and that does happen more in the United States. But the absence of that here means that our constitutional stuff tends to be a bit dry, a bit boring, a bit absent from the sort of media that people actually enjoy consuming. And unless it's a bit entertaining, then we need to be realistic about people's willingness to consume it.
So, Mo, you're a young Australian. What are your thoughts on why the Constitution doesn't appear to capture the imagination of young Australians and that they know so little about it?
I suppose there's a disconnect with the knowledge about the Constitution and its relevance to our daily lives. You know, we've rarely seen the Constitution come into play in the lives of Australians, let alone young Australians. And admittedly, I don't even remember learning about the Constitution. Now, I don't know if that's a reflection of my public high school, which I won't name, but or something deeper and something more systemic. But I think certainly we do need far more comprehensive civic education around the Constitution and its importance in our nation's identity, and also where we want to go as a country. You know, we're going to hear about Indigenous recognition and obviously other human rights discussions as well. So the Constitution is actually relevant, but that connection isn't being made throughout the public sphere enough.
I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.